Is this your idea of making dinner?
Hi, I'd like to order some pizza, please.
Pick up or delivery?
Delivery.
Okay. And what do you like? What kind of pizzas do you like?
I need to order two pizzas, large.
What kind?
Could you lure reluctant cooks back into the kitchen for healthier meals? I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
When I got here, I felt calm, and I feel relaxed.
It's basically what most of my act is, a parody of a scientific seminar.
It was just everywhere, and I realized looking at it that I was outmatched.
It's a virus that likes to attack lots of different organ systems.
The two-dimensional plane is the dance floor,
it's essentially
and the particles are the dance.
You wouldn't know it's a well.
My mom said, call 911.
I would say that they're ginormous questions.
On today's show, an investigation into the treatment of pregnant inmates in Pennsylvania prisons. Also, does medical marijuana reduce the number of opioid overdoses? And the sex lives of corals. They like a rather romantic setting. But first up, in the fight against obesity, public health officials, the government, and doctors are trying all kinds of things. In Philadelphia, they've added fresh food to corner stores. Chain restaurants now list calorie counts on their menu. The schools have banned soda and vending machines and nixed deep fryers in the cafeteria. There's even a program to make Chinese takeout healthier. Still, about 40% of Philadelphia kids are overweight or obese, and that number is even higher in certain neighborhoods. One of the newest ideas to get healthy in Philly tries to revive a fading tradition, the family dinner. Tanya English reports.
So welcome everyone to the tour. We want to introduce ourselves.
On a Saturday this summer, Casey Esposito from the Food Trust and Leanne Brown, who's a cookbook author, led a tour of the farmers market in Philadelphia's Clark Park.
If you've never had asparagus on the grill, you've never had asparagus.
Oh, yeah. The edges get all blackened.
And it's like the char.
Crunchy.
Exactly. It gets a lovely smoky flavor.
Brown's cookbook, Good and Cheap, is for people who live on a food stamp budget. The Food Trust is on a mission to get nutritious food to more city people.
Seasonal fruits and vegetables, you barely have to do anything to them for them to be delicious.
The duo introduced some of the less familiar produce. There were garlic scapes and an aptly turnip-looking purple thing called kohlrabi.
So this is it. It looks kind of like an alien. It's very fun.
On the tour, Esposito answered questions from the crowd. Yes, you can use food stamps here at the farmers market. Yes, she said, it's a great place to shop for dinner. But when Esposito talks to low-income moms, they've got some pre-existing ideas about farmers markets.
They think that the food is too expensive. They think that the food is unfamiliar, that it doesn't have a lot of the food that they like and that they want to cook at home.
Fresh vegetables are cheap eats. But Brown says that doesn't matter much if the produce ends up wilted and unused in the refrigerator.
Have a plan for those turnips. Have a plan for the blueberries. There's a lot that we can do with very little money if we are competent cooks. People think they're not good at cooking because they've tried it once or twice and it hasn't worked out. They've burned something. You know, it wasn't as good as it was at a restaurant or, you know, that time their mom or their dad made it.
Philadelphia has really doubled down on farmers markets. They're all across the region these days. But now, some advocates say the next needed step is to really teach people to cook.
Move the needle a little bit towards preparing both healthier meals, but also preparing food more frequently.
Pediatrician Senbagam Veerodachalam is a researcher at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. She's studying how to give families skills to cook at home. And she wonders if that change will translate to better health for kids. The idea started with a five-year-old patient.
He was having cereal for breakfast in the morning many days, and those were often sugary cereals with whole milk. I would say typical dinner would be a mix of takeout or fast food with occasionally food cooked at home. And even the food being cooked at home was often fried.
Veerodachalam shared her usual laundry list of recommendations. Less TV, more vegetables, no soda. About one-third of children in the United States are overweight or obese by the time they start school. So Veerodachalam has that talk with parents all the time. She sat down with the boy's mom, and they hashed out a plan. But she says the advice didn't seem to stick until the two were chatting in the busy waiting room.
She said, "Doctor, tell me, what do you eat every day? What do you do when you wake up in the morning?" And I started to tell her, I get up in the morning, I brush my teeth, I put my oatmeal in the microwave, and I'm getting into my regular routines. And within about 15 seconds, that waiting room was so quiet, you could hear a pin drop. Every parent was listening to what I was saying.
From that experience, she designed a cooking class for the parents of preschool kids. Each class is designed to be a confidence-building experience.
And you're going to help your sister get the dinner off the kitchen table and bring it into the living room table, because I'm going to let you make your own plate. How about that? Get the plates and the forks.
West Philadelphia mom Tamika Norman took the class, but with five people to feed, she says, frankly, fast food and carryout are always going to be more convenient.
Chinese store is right there on the corner, a block away, and on every corner we have either a Chinese store or what we call it, a poppy store, who does the fast food for you also. And a pizza store delivers.
There is a pretty good grocery store just a few streets down, but here's the thing.
Oh, I don't like to cook at all. Like, that's my main reason. I don't like to cook.
She has not changed her mind. But in class, Norman learned the trick of do-ahead cooking. She prepares two big meals on Sunday, and on this particular Tuesday night, the Normans are reheating dinner.
I'm having meatloaf, potatoes, and peas. The green button has a 30 and start on it. The beeping noise to tell us it's done.
All right, what next?
I'm gonna open it up, take my plate out, close the microwave, and I just walk into the living room.
First grader Shayla has a mouthful of food and a lot to say about table manners.
He had to do all the things, like be nice and be really responsible.
Micah, who's almost four, knows the rules too.
And you drank too quickly, you have the hiccups. But if you take your time, you won't have no hiccups.
It's all pretty simple. Meat, a couple of vegetables, then fruit for dessert.
Peaches, too.
Shayla, do you want blueberries?
No.
And then we got to cut the strawberries. Ready?
No,
we're going to do that one first because I hate it. Wait a minute.
There is no whipped cream tonight. Still, everyone seems pretty happy with dinner, and it all got accomplished without stopping for burgers and fries.
One of the things I was really hoping people would gain, and I think they did, was a sense of being able to get home at the end of the day, look at what's in the fridge and the pantry, and make something.
Pediatrician Senbagam Veeradachalam says almost any meal prepared from scratch at home is healthier than takeout or processed frozen food. But food is just one part of her big plan to bring back family dinner. Routines are important for kids, and she hopes this one healthy routine will lead to others at home.
In order to get three square healthy meals a day on the table, a lot of other things have to be going right in a family.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
So you had to go upstairs, take your clothes off, get washed, put pajamas on, and when you come back down, we'll do homework.
Okay, but can I order the rest of the plants first?
Laura Benchoff contributed to this story. Philadelphia has been working on its weight problem for more than a decade. Lots of kids are still too big, but there are some signs of improvement. Obesity among city school children dropped by 5% between 2006 and 2010. By the way, could the Norman kids possibly look any cuter than they sound? Find out for yourself on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. On to some interesting news out this week. Research that explores a relationship between legalizing medical marijuana and opioid overdose deaths. The data was published online in the Journal of the American Medical Association Internal Medicine. And joining us now is Marcus Bachhuber. He is the lead researcher for this study. He's an internist and part of the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program at the Philadelphia VA. Marcus, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Marcus, what did you set out to investigate? This was a team effort of sorts.
I'm a primary care doctor, and in my practice, I take care of a lot of patients that have chronic pain. And I've heard from some patients in the past that marijuana was the only thing that worked for their pain. And some patients would even say that they had tried prescription painkillers, such as morphine, Percocet, Vicodin, and those didn't work. And so they ended up using marijuana, which they found helped them. So in talking with some colleagues over the years, I had wondered how this might play out in states that had legal medical marijuana. So would people switch from opioid painkillers to medical marijuana, or would they supplement with medical marijuana and be able to decrease their painkiller dose? If either of those were the case, then states with legal medical marijuana might see lower rates of opioid overdose deaths.
Let me ask you, though, what do we know about people who overdose on opioids? Are they typically in medical care? Are the opioids prescribed to them?
That's a great question. And so we're still learning more information about this. But from what we know now, about 60% of people that overdose and die are people that have a legitimate prescription from a single provider. The other 40% either have prescriptions from multiple providers or obtain the medicines through other sources. So it's difficult to know of that 60% how many of them were abusing or misusing and how many of them were actually following their doctor's instructions. But we think that a large portion of people, it was unintentional overdoses that happened even in spite of following their doctor's instructions.
So what was the data set you dug into?
We got data on death certificates from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. They released this data publicly. And we looked at rates of prescription painkiller overdoses in all states from 1999 to 2010. And we compared rates in states that had medical marijuana laws and states that didn't. And we found that in the years after implementation of a medical marijuana law, there was about a 25% lower rate of prescription opioid painkiller overdose deaths than we would expect based on previous year's trends and trends in the rest of the country. And it's important to note that this wasn't a 25% decrease. This was a 25% lower rate than we would have expected based on the previous year's trends and what was happening in the rest of the country. In all states from 1999 to 2010, the rate of painkiller overdoses increased.
But can we know whether people in those states substituted medical marijuana for opioids in treating their chronic pain?
That's a great question. And going into the study, that was our hypothesis. But from our design, we can't tell the exact reason behind our findings. So it could be that people with chronic pain were substituting or switching to marijuana. It could also be that these medical marijuana laws alter the way that people who are addicted to opioids either abuse them or misuse them. Or it could be something else entirely.
In states where medical marijuana is permitted, what do we know about how physicians use medical marijuana to help patients control chronic pain?
Currently, there's 23 states that have medical marijuana laws, plus the District of Columbia. So in many states, medical marijuana can be recommended for a variety of medical conditions, from nausea or cancer-related symptoms or pain or glaucoma and a couple other things. And a few states make their enrollment information public. And so when looking at those states, we find that chronic pain is the vast majority of people. So the vast majority of people report chronic or severe pain as the reason for taking marijuana. So, for example, in Oregon, this is something like over 90% of people registered for medical marijuana report chronic or severe pain as the reason.
What is the kind of feedback you've been getting for this study? Has this kind of perked up interest?
So this is two very controversial topics. I knew that it was controversial when we started looking into it, but I was honestly surprised by the amount of attention that it's gotten. I would say from the beginning, we felt it was very important to be open and transparent about the limitations of our approach and the limitations of our study. And so a lot of people have focused on those limitations, which we, you know, realize and we're the first to admit.
And this is a very political topic, too.
Yeah, this is exceedingly political.
And I guess this is difficult not just because it's a very political issue, but it also has this correlation and causation question that often vexes researchers, right?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. So, you know, establishing causation in medical research is very difficult. And the usual standard is a randomized controlled trial where you randomly select people to receive one treatment or another. It's hard for me to think of a way that you could apply that design to this research question. And so in situations like this, we're left to use or to analyze the data that are out there. So we controlled for many of the differences between the states, but it's possible that states were working to address the problem of overdoses at the same time that they implemented medical marijuana laws, and that the things that they did to address that problem had nothing to do with medical marijuana laws. So in that case, it would make it look like the medical marijuana laws had an association, but really it was related to other factors.
So what would you like to study next? What would be interesting to investigate now that you have this kind of base finding?
So I think what's necessary now would be studies of large numbers of individuals over time to see how these laws might shift individual behavior. So these could be people with chronic pain who are candidates for medical marijuana, or these could be people at risk of abusing marijuana or abusing opioids, and tracking them over time to see how these laws might affect them.
Marcus Bachhuber is an internist, and he's part of the Robert Wood Johnson Clinical Scholars Program at the Philadelphia VA. Marcus, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And this disclosure, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation is a supporter of The Pulse. Coming up, utility companies in Pennsylvania want consumers to track their energy usage through smart meters.
And then you can actually see hour by hour what's happening. So, like, this is when I shower.
Okay, but what can you do with that info? Still to come on The Pulse here on WHYY.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca's patient assistance programs help qualified patients access the AstraZeneca medicines they need while providing them with information that can help them stay healthy. In 2013, AstraZeneca served more than 567,000 patients through its prescription savings programs, including AZ and Me and the MedImmune Assistance Program. Learn more at azandme.com and myaccess360.com.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. How smart is your electric meter? Pennsylvania is requiring the state's major utilities to install new techie meters, which paint a more detailed picture of how and when we're using energy. Utilities are encouraging customers to use that information to make themselves smarter about their energy use. Reporter Katie Collinari asked, does it actually make a difference?
I'm following Crystal Eason down into the basement of her West Philadelphia home.
Yeah, so this is what it looks like.
She shows me the smart meter her utility, Pico, installed back in February. The total number of kilowatts her family's used in the last month flashes on the screen of a silver dial mounted to the wall. Back upstairs, Eason logs onto a website Pico designed to show her in greater detail what the meter is measuring. On the computer screen is a line graph that looks like a heart monitor, showing how much energy her family used last Saturday. The line starts out flat. Then around 7 a.m., there's a spike.
And then you can actually see hour by hour what's happening. So, like, this is when I shower.
For years, Pennsylvanians like Eason just got a bill once a month, telling them how much energy they used and how much it cost. But a 2008 state law is changing that. It requires the seven largest utilities to install smart meters on every home and business. The devices send information back to utilities more frequently, so they get a more accurate read of their customers' demand on the electric grid. And remember all those outages last winter? Smart meters tell utilities where the power's still out more effectively after storms. Pennsylvania wants utilities to go a step further. They have to come up with a plan to share the information these meters collect with their customers. PICO spokeswoman Kathy Engel-Menendez says it's to help them make smarter choices that will save them energy and money.
So then it would suggest to the customer, you might want to consider, what is the caulking around your windows and doors? Is that something you should look at? When was the last time you replaced your heater?
The first step is just getting consumers to look. For Eason, it should be a no-brainer. She works at the Energy Co-op, an alternative energy supplier in Philadelphia. It's her job to get people to understand how much energy they could be wasting. At first, Eason was fascinated by what her smart meter revealed.
I was wondering what was costing so much on our bill, and I had assumed it was probably our electric hot water heater, but didn't know for sure. And then being able to see this data really confirmed that it was every time we were using our hot water was when it was peaking.
So she tried taking shorter showers, but her interest quickly waned.
I checked it maybe one or two more times, to see what was happening, and then I completely forgot about it.
That doesn't surprise George Lowenstein, a behavioral economist at Carnegie Mellon University. He says it's just like counting calories to lose weight. Most of us start out enthusiastically, and then we fall off the wagon.
It is a common pattern that people tend to look at information a lot initially, and then they stop looking over time. People tend to be attuned to things that change, and once something is constant in the environment, we generally tend to ignore it.
Casey Boyce is with the nonprofit Smart Grid Consumer Collaborative. The group works with utilities to find out how customers are interacting with their smart meters.
There's fairly limited participation right now nationally, but at the same time, we're seeing a really high level of demand that if they're offered to consumers, about two-thirds of consumers are really interested in taking advantage of these kinds of tools.
Lowenstein cites one reason many consumers aren't monitoring their energy use.
I think most people feel overwhelmed by information. Consumers would really like the devices to be making decisions for them.
For example, the way so-called smart thermostats like the Nest learn users' schedules to automatically adjust the temperature. Another obstacle to these smart devices, some consumers worry the meters could give their utilities more information than they'd care to share, or that their data could be vulnerable to hackers. The Pennsylvania Public Utility Commission says the information is safe. Utilities in Pennsylvania have the next 10 years to roll out their smart meters. Some companies in the western part of the state are just getting started. In Philadelphia, PECO plans to finish installing smart meters for all of its 1.6 million customers by the end of this year. The company is also testing an in-home digital monitor that gives consumers a direct line of sight to how much energy they're using and what it costs. Crystal Eason says she's open to the idea if it helps them make smarter investments.
With energy efficiency, you really need to do big things. You need to have your windows sealed and, you know, make sure your walls are well insulated.
Aside from her tendency to linger in the shower, there's another reason Eason's hot water heater is raising her electric bill. Her two young kids. The Eason's use cloth diapers, which means they're doing laundry much more often. It also means they're going to use more electricity.
That's kind of the trade-off. We use more water using cloth diapers, but less landfill. It's kind of deciding which is the lesser evil.
For The Pulse, I'm Katie Colinari.
You're listening to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Imagine a full moon over the open ocean. Sounds romantic, right? Well, apparently corals think so too. In our regular segment, So What Do You Do?, where lay people interview scientists about their work, we meet Allison Sweeney of the University of Pennsylvania. Sweeney spoke about the sex lives of corals with Shauna Small, a school psychologist in Philadelphia and Camden. Shauna Small asked Allison Sweeney,
So what do you do?
I'm primarily a scientist. I have a professorship in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. However, my degrees are all in biology. My PhD is in evolutionary biology.
How would you explain to someone who doesn't understand, someone who's not very scientific, how biology and physics comes together?
In my work, specifically optics, there's a long, beautiful history of using physics to understand vision and how eyes work per se. In my own work, I'm more interested in environmental light. It turns out there's a lot of physical complexity in color signals and intensity signals that happens over days and over months in the world. And we are just beginning to understand that this color complexity can actually have a lot of important biological ramifications. We wanted to know how light at twilight might contribute to the synchrony of coral spawnings on coral reefs around the world.
And how does the spawning occur?
Corals are animals, and they're animals without brains, and they cover vast territories in the oceans. To reproduce every year, corals free spawn, which means that eggs and sperm get released simultaneously into the water. And it's actually in the open ocean that eggs and sperm get together and make
they
little coral babies.
Wow. Yeah.
So finding each other is a tricky, tricky problem when you're talking about, you know, releasing into the open ocean. And the way they facilitate eggs and sperm finding each other is to spawn within a 10-minute interval once a year. So these brainless animals know precisely which 10 minutes of the year they're supposed to release their reproductive output for the year. And by having miles and miles and miles of coral reefs all spawn in the same 10 minutes, and it greatly, greatly increases the probability that eggs and sperms are going to get together, make coral babies. We don't know how the corals know exactly, but we do know that the corals will tend to want to spawn 3 or 4 nights after the full moon. So what we were curious about is it turns out that there are these chromatic processes. So twilight, the period of time as the sun is setting, the color of the sky actually gets much bluer than it is during the day.
Mm-hmm.
And the full moon itself is actually pretty red compared to sort of daylight color.
Mm-hmm.
And so as you go through the lunar cycle, the night of the full moon is exactly on the horizon as the sun sets. And every night in the lunar cycle that you go past that, the moon is lower and lower and lower down.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that every twilight after the full moon gets bluer and bluer and bluer. And so there's this whole color process in the sky that if you were a coral, it would make a lot of sense to pay attention to. We wanted to actually measure exactly what was going on in the light where the coral lived to ask, is there enough information there that this could be something that they could be paying attention to? And the answer turned out to be yes. We don't know if for sure that's what corals are paying attention to, but it definitely is another option. So we can maybe narrow the mystery down. It wasn't even clear up until we sort of did this work what the heck sort of physical cues they could be picking up on. You know, it's hard to come up with something that just wasn't sort of invoking magic.
Right.
We were at least able to pinpoint some real physical process in the world that is plausible and big enough for corals to sort of see in some sense, whatever seeing means for a coral.
Mm-hmm. Or sense or whatever.
Sense, yes. Big enough for corals to sense that is also happening at the same time when they spawn. So
I feel definitely more informed about what you do in the Department of Astronomy and Physics.
Thanks so much for chatting today. It's been super fun.
Yeah. So great meeting you.
Yep, you too.
Allison Sweeney is an assistant professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Pennsylvania. She spoke with Shauna Small, a school psychologist in Philadelphia and Camden. Would you like to be part of So What Do You Do, either as a scientist or as an interviewer? Please email us at thepulse@whyy.org.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission to explore strange new...
Okay, so you remember the opening sequence of Star Trek, The Next Generation, as Starship Enterprise takes a swift left turn past a comet and glides through a vast amount of nothing. What is space made of? What is this huge vacuum? It's a question that has vexed humanity for quite some time. Since the 1930s, scientists have theorized about dark matter, which is believed to be responsible for keeping the galaxy and universe together with its gravity. But it cannot be directly detected, so its exact makeup remains elusive. Results from the particle detector attached to the International Space Station could perhaps bring us closer to getting a grasp on dark matter. Joining us now is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, thank you so much for being here.
Sure, my pleasure.
Derek, what is your best working definition of dark matter? Because it's hard to keep your head wrapped around what this even is.
It is difficult to keep your head wrapped around what dark matter is, because dark matter is a term that's used to describe matter that's part of the universe, part of the structure of the universe, but that we can't detect in any way. And I think that's probably the most important piece to hold on to about this, is we're talking about what you might call substance, but it doesn't have any of the characteristics of substance that astronomers would typically identify of matter to have, particularly in the case of what's going on with this. So
we can't see it.
We can't detect it in any way. And so a little bit of background here. Astronomers really depend on being able to detect energy in space coming from processes in which energy is generated, or being able to identify matter in one way or another because it interacts with energies and you can detect it. Here we're talking about something, some stuff, that gives us no signature whatsoever, except for one thing, and that is the fact that it pushes on stuff. And we can calculate exactly what that push is, and we can figure out how much of that push is around in the universe, and we can definitely see the effect that push is having.
So bring us up to speed on the recent developments in the dark matter mystery.
Well, the most recent developments in the dark matter mystery are that we have been able to determine how much dark matter there is. And it's like 4 to 5% of the matter of the universe is us. And
us meaning?
Us meaning the real stuff, the real hard stuff that we can grab hold of and touch and feel and see and detect. Planets and stars and galaxies and dust and energy. That's all 5%, 4 to 5% of the universe. The other 95%, 95 to 96% of the universe is dark matter and dark energy, most of which is dark matter, some of which is the dark energy.
Derek, we might be coming a little closer to potentially solving some of the questions surrounding dark matter, correct?
Yes, we may be coming closer. International Space Station has on board, mounted on the exterior of the station, an alpha magnetic spectrometer package that is set up to detect cosmic rays coming from all kinds of events out in space. And it's theorized that it may be possible that some of those hits that are being detected might be related to dark matter. So theoretically, we believe that this is what exists, and we can see the effect, but we can't detect anything from it. So in an effort to try to detect something from it, the alpha magnetic spectrometer has been taking cosmic ray hits, and the analysis of these cosmic ray hits may lead us to have a better understanding about the nature of dark matter if we can actually identify that these cosmic ray hits are a result of dark matter interactions. So that's what we're trying to see with this. There have been some hits. There have been plenty of hits. Millions, hundreds of millions of hits. But the problem is, can we actually determine that these hits are directly related to dark matter activity? If it turns out that they actually are cosmic rays resulting from interactions of dark matter with other material, then we have a way to be able to detect the existence of dark matter, and then perhaps a way to try to trace its interaction around the universe. And that's very exciting, because at the moment, we have nothing. We have absolutely nothing. So it's always a great question to answer when people say, what is dark matter? Because the answer right now is, we don't know. We don't know what dark matter is. All we know is what the effect is. So hopefully this detector can help lead us down the path to being able to identify more of what it is.
So how exciting would it be, just talking about your career, to perhaps really get a grasp on what dark matter is?
Well, answering the question about dark matter has to be one of the most exciting challenges that physicists, astrophysicists have before them, for a couple of reasons. Because of the effect that it has on the structure and behavior of the universe, but also in a philosophical sense, because it always brings me back to the fact that if dark matter and its companion dark energy are so much more dominant in the structure and behavior of the universe than the 4% of matter that makes up the stuff that we know, then to me it suggests that the universe is much more about the dark matter than it is about us. So in a way, you can consider the us to be a byproduct of this other process that's governed by the dark matter. There's a major switch for you about our place in the universe.
And are you hopeful that we'll get there? We are getting closer to understanding this?
Certainly more hopeful that we are beginning to pull together some pieces of the puzzle that can better help us understand how this works. Because if we can answer the question about dark energy, it can help us to answer so many other questions about how the universe works. This is critically important because one of the things we really have to be able to try to understand is Is this the only universe? Are there other universes that exist adjacent to ours that we can't see? Can dark matter help us better understand this structure that we now believe is not singular, but that there are many, many universes of which this is just one? How do we get some more grasp, some more purchase, some more handle on the realities of that?
Derek Pitts, you'll keep us posted, I hope.
Yes, I certainly will. As soon as I find out, I'll be sure to let you know.
Derek Pitts is chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Coming up on The Pulse, an investigation into the treatment of pregnant inmates in Pennsylvania prisons.
The correctional officer took the handcuff off her and put it on one of her ankles so that she could hold her baby. And I'm sitting there watching this whole process, and I'm thinking, this is just totally ridiculous.
Next on The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
AstraZeneca supports WHYY's The Pulse. AstraZeneca is dedicated to improving health in communities across the Philadelphia region. On Twitter at AstraZeneca US or on Facebook at AstraZeneca US Community Connections.
Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. The American Medical Association calls the practice of shackling pregnant inmates dangerous to both mother and child. And in 2010, Pennsylvania passed a law against the practice. Corrections workers are not supposed to shackle pregnant inmates after their second trimester. But reporter Audrey Quinn finds evidence that pregnant Pennsylvania inmates are still being shackled despite the law. The story was reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute.
Danielle Williams will never forget the first prisoner birth she attended.
The whole time, her left wrist was handcuffed to the railing of the side of the bed. And it stayed that way the entire time that she was going through labor and giving birth.
This was back in 2008. Williams had just created a doula program for Philadelphia prisoners. She was one of the first outsiders to see what an inmate birth looked like.
And then after she had the baby, she wanted to breastfeed. And so the correctional officer took the handcuff off her and put it on one of her ankles so that she could hold her baby.
Williams said the woman's ankle was clamped to the sidebar of the bed. Breastfeeding was not happening.
So the correctional officer kind of created this longer extension by combining two handcuffs together and the chains that she had came to the hospital with so that she could have more length in the restraint while she breastfed her baby. And I'm sitting there watching this whole process and I'm thinking, this is just totally ridiculous. And it's just something very barbaric. And as an African-American woman watching another African-American woman, I was just thinking about all sorts of things.
Williams figured that if other people outside the prison system or hospital staff, knew this kind of shackling was happening in Pennsylvania, it wouldn't be legal anymore. And in a way, that was true. She got word out about what she'd seen. By 2010, there was a whole crew of advocates and legislators speaking out against shackling during labor. Their bill to prohibit the practice, the Healthy Birth for Incarcerated Women Act, it became law. The shackling of Pennsylvania inmates any time past their second trimester of pregnancy, it's no longer legal. But it turns out in Pennsylvania, there's a difference between a practice being illegal and a practice ending. Earlier this year, the Pennsylvania ACLU reported hospital staff across the state still say they see inmates come in to give birth with handcuffs on. Pennsylvania Corrections' own records show 109 times pregnant women were shackled in the 2012-2013 fiscal year. And that's just in jails that report it. Pennsylvania State Senator Dalen Leach was the primary author of the anti-shackling bill.
Now we're just working to get it implemented effectively.
Yeah, I guess I have this like simplistic view as just a layperson where I'm like, oh, a law is passed. Now people have to do this thing.
Yeah. The fact is, when you do pass new legislation, you do have to sort of notify people as to the requirements of that legislation, particularly the people who are going to be dealing with that legislation.
To some people, not shackling pregnant women seems like a no-brainer. But to many corrections workers, this goes against a very basic tenet of prison life. When an inmate gets escorted off prison grounds, they get shackled.
Hi, may I please speak to Warden Cooper?
Is Warden Cooper going to help you?
Sean Cooper's the warden at Snyder County Prison. He says they still sometimes shackle pregnant inmates who go on doctor's visits.
I don't want to have to explain to the public why I let an inmate overtake one of the officers because they weren't restrained.
He worries inmates could see someone they know in a doctor's waiting room and try to make a run for it. Cooper says he would never shackle a woman in her third trimester or a woman in labor, but he doesn't think the public realizes how dangerous some pregnant women can be.
So there could potentially be a time when there's going to be an exception made, and we may be forced to put handcuffs on a female during a transport just because we've got officer safety, we've got inmate safety, we've got the community safety, we've got a lot of factors that go into making that decision.
When Senator Leach and his collaborators wrote Pennsylvania's anti-shackling law, they made sure to allow for exceptions. If correction officers think a woman's dangerous to herself or others, they can still use the restraints. But in some jails, it seems like this exception gets used pretty liberally. I submitted a Freedom of Information Act request for records of pregnant inmate shackling at Blair County Prison. It's about 90 miles east of Pittsburgh, in the middle of the state. The county sent me records of more than 100 incidences where pregnant Blair County inmates were shackled over a year and a half. This is a prison that only handles about 55 women at a time. On each record sheet, the warden gets a space to explain why each pregnant woman needed to be shackled. There's 15 lines of blank space, and the form says the warden can use the back side of the page if necessary. I lined up all the record sheets by the dates they got filled out. The reasons why each woman was shackled, they followed a pattern. For the first couple of months of reports, the record said restraints were used for safety reasons. The next few months, the excuse is security reasons. After that, officers simply stated security as the reason for shackling. There's barely any reference to the women's own behavior, just the phrasing du jour for why shackles were needed. I called up Blair County Warden Matt Johnston. I was curious to ask why so much shackling was happening during pregnancies. I'm not interested in talking about that, he told me. Neither was the Blair County Commissioner. I got no comment from the Office of County Inspection and Services. And the Pennsylvania Attorney General's office told me they couldn't talk to me about shackling by the Department of Corrections. The department is their client. No one would admit responsibility for shackling oversight.
You have individual correctional facilities policing themselves.
That's Danielle Williams again, the prison doula who helped spark the anti-shackling law.
There's no uniform accountability.
Like, how do you even figure out who's to blame?
Exactly. I don't know. I wish I knew. I think if there was an identified body that can really be held accountable and there were some concrete consequences to violating the bill, it wouldn't be violated as much.
One place advocates say the law against shackling pregnant women has worked is in Philadelphia. At the county's women's jail, Riverside Correctional Facility. The Philadelphia prison system invited the Maternity Care Coalition's Mommobile program to set up an outpost here in 2008. They offer support for pregnant inmates and inmates with kids. Today, inmate Kenesha Tyler is visiting with caseworker Rosalind Washington.
Hi, sweetie.
How are you, doll?
Good.
Tyler gave birth to a baby girl 2 months ago.
My daughter, 13 pounds. I left. She was 10 pounds. I want to see her. Like,
it's so great.
I miss her so much.
The Mommobile program offers parenting classes, and caseworkers like Washington meet with women to talk about motherhood both during and after their time at Riverside. They also offer doula services for pregnant inmates. It's actually the doula program that Danielle Williams had helped start back in 2008. LaToya Myers now runs the program. She says Riverside doulas serve an extra role when they attend inmate births. They support the prisoner, but they're also a third party to make sure correction officers keep accountable for not shackling pregnant inmates.
I actually think that this really works. So having a nonprofit agency come in, we want to make sure that, and I think that the jail here really wants to make sure that the woman has a safe birth experience as well. So if anything seems a little bit off, I can call one of the majors in the middle of the night, and they will make sure that it gets handled.
Myers thinks the success of the anti-shackling law at Riverside Jail, it offers hope that the anti-shackling law can be followed elsewhere, but the state correctional system is yet to take action. For The Pulse, I'm Audrey Quinn.
Listening to The Pulse, I'm Maiken Scott. It's time now for our series Patient Files, your stories of illness, recovery, and healing. Today we hear from a 70-year-old Vietnam veteran who recently competed in the National Veterans Wheelchair Games that took place in Philadelphia. He says playing sports was instrumental in reclaiming his life after a devastating injury.
My name is Eugene Tatum Sr. I live here in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. In Mount Airy, I was in the United States Marine Corps. You know, I stepped on a landmine in Vietnam. I was there. I had one day to go. I got hit on, I think it was the 18th. I was leaving the 19th. Both legs was damaged, all between my legs, all the way up, and my heart. I was hitting the heart there, you know. But through therapy and all, and the doctors did piece me back together. You know, I got to where I can get around. Well, when I first came home, I was in hospital for 2.5 years at the Naval Hospital. I had a visit from a guy named John Rosette. He's passed away since, but he came to visit. And he said, have you ever played any sports? I said, yeah. He knew I did, too. He was just asking me to see where I was at mentally. I said, yeah, I played in school. He said, well, would you like to participate in sports again? I'm in traction. Guys tell me about participating in sports. You know, that's kind of... What are you, crazy or something? You know, he said, no, would you come out and watch? I said, I'll come out and watch. I have nothing else to do. I'm sitting here. I'm locked in bed. So they can take me anywhere they want to take me. He said, well, then come out and watch. And they took me out to watch the guys play wheelchair ball. And when I seen that, my belief is that if you can do it, I can do it. You know, I said, well, look, I play. But I had to go all through therapy then. So now I had a reason to go to therapy, not just get out, but a reason to play ball now. And John stayed on me. He came up to visit me every day and gave me things to do, to exercise. And they had one course down there at the Navy Yard, a long strip that went up 45-degree angle up to the top. And if you could push your wheelchair all the way down and up that ramp, and it was far, he said, you can come out on the floor. The chair I was in was about 65, 75 pounds. The chair was really big. It was high. It took me almost 2 weeks. Couldn't get up it. And this one day, I got 3/4 of the way up, and I put my head down. I said, I'm getting up this thing. And I finally got up over it. And when I got up over it, I was allowed to go out to the gym with the fellas. Then they introduced me to these sport chairs. From that point on, working with them, my career took off because I got back in the pool, and I started swimming. So then I was participating in track and field, and swimming and basketball. Well, anytime I get down and out, I go work out. The gym is an out for me. Without the gym, I don't know what I would be or what I would do. But I'm able to express myself there and get everything out. When I come home, I feel much better. You know, but that's what sports do. You know, I wear myself out, I go back, I can deal with anything then. But if I don't go work out after a week or so, I get sick, I am moody to be around. You know, and I said, that's the whole thing. I have to go to the gym. And of course, you bump heads with your wife and all because she gets tired of you. You're always in the gym. That's the only place I can go where I feel good at. You know, and it's part of me anyway. It's part of my makeup. And I don't think I will ever stop doing it either. Every now and then, you do have those times when you look back and you say, why me? Why did it have to happen to me? You know, but then you stop and think about this. How about the guys that didn't make it who died? So at least you came home. And my thing was that there's a purpose for all of us coming home. Look, these young guys coming, what we're trying to do is give them what was not given to us. We approach them with everything. What do you need help with? Tell them where to go at. And like I always tell them, I might not be as quick to get to some point, or I might not be able to jump as high or run as fast, but I can still do those things just at a slower pace, that's all. And I know that I gotta be above it
now. And I know that I can't let them bring me down. Vietnam veteran Eugene Tatum Sr., who recently competed in the National Veterans Wheelchair Games in Philadelphia. Tatum participated in 7 different events and scored a total of 4 gold medals, 1 silver, and 1 bronze. Did I mention he's 70? That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Alana Gordon. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Joel Patterson, our associate producer. Megan Pinto is the executive producer. Chris Atulo is vice president of news, and Christine Dempsey, our chief content officer. If you missed some of this show or any of our previous shows, subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And we always love to hear from you. Email us with your feedback, your questions, your ideas at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.